Blog Talk Radio.
Regular guest Woody on at 9:15.
Yeah.
To do his part, Woody in the Ring. So we'll talk to him at 9:15. Until then, we'll give you news and views.
Yeah.
Our views and some news and views of
others. Yeah.
Maybe what our take is on it.
Our views and other news. And first thing I want
what's
to start.
What's going
with,
on?
Yeah. Sorry, I got off.
The GOP threw the 2012 election to Obama in 2009. Multi-billion dollar Ponzi scheme involving Romney and his son. Let's go to that and see just what, how much news we have, what, who this article is from and what they have to say.
Anyway, I want to read about the FDA. And
this is from the Libertarian Review. Not too familiar with this.
Yeah, give it a second.
This
you have to wait on this. This thing is. Whenever you go to another website, it kind of gets whacked. There we go.
And this article is by. Let's see who it's by.
Libertarian Review.
I thought there was a
no,
writer.
Well, it's a writer for the Libertarian Review.
It just doesn't give his name or her name.
Yeah.
Or her name.
Okay, so, in other words, GOP threw 2012 election to Obama in 2009, according to this. Multi-billion dollar Ponzi scheme involving Romney and son. I really thought that was a strange thing. But as reported here and here several weeks ago, we reported that Romney would certainly be disqualified for or discredited as a presidential candidate for 2012 election due to fraud and other crimes against American taxpayers and the U.S. government. As far back as 2009, nearly concurrent with Bernie Madoff's Ponzi scandal, the GOP knew beyond any doubt that Mitt Romney was seriously involved with a Ponzi scheme to the tune of $8.5 billion. In February 2009, the Washington Post revealed that the SEC was alleging $8 billion in savings fraud by Alan Sanford and his colleagues, Reed, Mitt Romney and son, of lying about investments in CDs in a Ponzi scheme concerning staggering amounts of investors' monies, partnerships in which they invested upon collapse of the fraud. We are alleging a fraud of shocking magnitude that has spread its tentacles throughout the world, Rose Romero, director of SEC's Fort Worth office, said in a statement. But yet, here he is again, running for president.
Perfect credentials for it.
Oh, yeah. Despite the action of the SEC in this case, a few months, and this is a quote, a few months after the Ponzi scheme collapsed, the firm financed by Mitt Romney and run by his son and chief fundraiser partner with the three men had created a new wealth management business as a subsidiary. So what do we know? We know that Sanford has a PAC, which has contributed large amounts of money to lawmakers annually. We know that over $400,000 of that money was tied directly to the Madoff Ponzi scandal. And we know that one is only sentenced if found guilty. And
sentencing has been set for June 14, 2012, at 10 a.m. in courtroom 8A before Judge Hittner. Stanford faces a maximum prison sentence of 20 years for the count of conspiracy to commit wire and mail fraud. Each count of wire and mail fraud and the count of conspiracy to commit money laundering and 5 years for the count of conspiracy to obstruct SEC investigation and the count of obstruction of an SEC investigation. Victims of this Ponzi scheme have been asked to fill out victim impact statements for the financial crime and have not as yet received compensation or restoration of fraudulently stolen funds. We know that Romney lied about the specifics of the Stanford fraud and still created a joint wealth management system with criminals. Mitt Romney, his son Tag, what a horrible name, and Romney's chief fundraiser, Spencer Zwick, have extensive financial and political ties to three men who have allegedly participated in an $8.5 billion Ponzi scheme. A few months after the Ponzi scheme collapsed, a firm financed by Mitt Romney and run by his son and chief fundraiser partnered with three men and created a new wealth management business as a subsidiary. Whereas the screwing those poor guys took actually was court-ordered forfeiture.
According to the indictment, which also seeks for forfeiture from all the defendants, Stanford and his co-defendants engaged in a scheme to defraud investors who purchased approximately $7 billion in certificates of deposit administered by Stanford International Bank Limited, an offshore bank controlled by Stanford and located in the island of Antigua. Stanford and his co-defendants allegedly misused and misappropriated most of those investor assets, including diverting more than $1.6 billion to undisclosed personal loans to Stanford himself, while misrepresenting to investors SIBL's financial condition, its investment strategy, and the extent of its regulatory oversight by Antiguan authorities.
Also according to the indictment, Stanford, Pendergast, Holt, and King conspired to conceal the fraud from the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission in order to fend off an SEC investigation. King allegedly provided Stanford and others with confidential information that he had received an official SEC inquiry into a possible fraud on investors by SIBL so that the additional false representation concerning SIBL's financial health and Antiguan regulatory oversight could be made. In addition, Stanford, Pendergast Holt, and others allegedly agreed that Pendergast Holt would provide false information to the SEC about the true value of SIBL's investment portfolio. We know that the charges are many and serious. It goes on. It's quite a long one.
The revelation about Romney's ties to the Stanford Ponzi scheme unmasked the risks associated with removing new investor protections. The Dodd-Frank Wall Street reform law, a reform Romney says he will repeal if he wins the presidency, attempts to address future Ponzi schemes by enacting new protections for whistleblowers to alert authorities when they find evidence of fraud. The law also creates a new investor advocate and investor advisory committee within the Securities and Exchange Commission to detect and investigate future Ponzi schemes.
So do you think he wants to make more money after
he's
president?
Of course, while
he's
president.
He
wants his buddies to, he's in blind trust,
Yeah.
As early as 2009 with the scandal, how much money do you need? This guy is these greed-ridden bastards, Mormonism whatever.
Let's sum up. So as to review, we have Mitt Romney coughing up $10 million to help start a firm that hired three brokers who sold bogus CDs for Stanford Financial and made some decent money on the deal, too. Not only that, but Spencer Zwick, the lead fundraiser for Romney's campaign, is a principal in the Solomare Capital firm along with these Stanford brokers. Spencer Zwick does business as SJZ and LLC and has been paid over $2 million in fees by the Romney campaign.
Now, what's interesting is, I just wanted to say, as early as 2009 with a scandal of major PAC being involved with leading Republican Mitt Romney, an honest vetting by the GOP would certainly have disqualified him for GOP support for the presidential elections. However, if the GOP, who in 2008 adopted the identical platform as the Democratic Party reworded, wanted to throw the election to Barack Obama, they could hardly do more to guarantee it for 2012.
Yeah. Since sentencing of the first convict begins in June of 2012, it is guaranteed to blow up as a major campaign issue into August, September, and November of this year and will affect the GOP campaigns. The criminal fraud not only of Madoff, and Stanford, but of the major banks and Wall Street firms, has so overwhelmed the economy of this country that voters would be hard-pressed to give office to one so deeply connected to these evils.
The GOP knew these things before Obama was elected. The GOP is, one more time, throwing the election into Obama's lap. And check out the author's personal website, which is margaretchout.com. So, you know, good luck, guys. You know, Romney. Who did I help? Romney. I knew he was a crook.
That's why his wife spends $900 on a blouse to her. It's nothing.
Yeah, yeah. Everyone wears it. Well, you know,
yeah, it's just they don't really work for their money. They just feel it.
Not that anybody would even, you know, I was thinking nobody would notice that.
I guess so.
But I wanted to, this one is, this is amazing. Yeah, just amazingly disgusting. But the FDA allows mold, insects, rodent hairs, ammonia, arsenic and maggots in reconditioned food. In order to save money, some corporations will repackage older food into new packaging and resell it.
Let's go to the real article.
Yeah. One public school lunch supplier tried this with moldy applesauce, recanned, and was reprimanded to never try that stunt again. Oh, yeah. Not like they didn't take his freaking license away. You know? Jeez. Creepers. You know, it just kills you what the FDA is, what a useless organization that is. And, the SDA was contacted.
The FDA.
What did I say?
SDA.
Yeah. The FDA was contacted by Snokist growers of Yakima, Washington. That this is just one group trying to ensure reworking food is not a normal practice. I was appalled that there were actually human beings that were okay with this, said Katha Schelke, a food scientist and spokesperson for the Institute of Food Technologists. This is a case of unsafe food. They are trying to salvage that to make a buck. Shockingly, J. Cole, former federal inspector who works with the FDA group, says any food can be reconditioned. And perhaps pieces of pasta will be reground into some semolina and mislabeled blueberry ice cream mixed with chocolate to avoid waste. Mm. And insect parts discovered in cocoa beans, live bugs left behind in dried fruit packages, or salmonella bacteria found in hydrolyzed. Yeah.
Vegetable protein,
which is a flavor enhancer
used in gravy mix, snack foods, dairy products, spices, and soups. This is how people do their business, says Schelke.
The FDA allows food producers like Basic Food Flavors, Inc. to recondition their recalled items in 210 by heat-treating their products to remove salmonella. At BFF then reprocess the food and distributed them for sale to the public.
That's disgusting.
Yeah, make sure you know these names. Basic Food Flavors, Inc., you know, these kind of things. The FDA justifies this unsafe practice by stating that it reduces water and saves money. Yet this occurs at the expense of public safety and health. If the processes approved by the FDA were rendering food safe for consumption, there would be less of an issue. The Snorkist official found that the process of the FDA permitted as safe for the reconditioning of applesauce rendered the food sterile and effectively worthless as a nutritional substance by a common toxin produced by the mold in the applesauce.
The FDA stands by its thermal process even though it does not protest against mycotoxins in the food. Mold is not easily reconditioned products, says William Correll, the FDA's acting director of compliance. The FDA admits they expect a certain level of contaminants and toxins to enter food during the processing process because they claim a zero tolerance policy would be too difficult to achieve. The FDA relies on defect action levels to define how dangerous a contaminant is in the food and how much enforcement of their policies they should engage the manufacturer in. Basically, if making the food safe is too difficult, the FDA does not bother enforcing their safety policies.
Yeah.
Here are a few examples of allowable contaminants. In 8 ounces of macaroni, there could be 225 insect fragments or 4.5 rodent hairs. In 3.5 ounces of canned mushrooms, 20 or more maggots is okay. In canned cranberry sauce, there could be an average of 15% mold.
Now, you eat that stuff. You like cranberry sauce.
Well, you eat the other stuff. The FDA finds
what?
These...
Yeah, I don't eat canned mushrooms.
You eat... Yeah, sometimes we do.
No, I don't. Never.
You see macaroni.
Yeah, well, I used to. I don't anymore.
The FDA finds these levels acceptable because they would be too much stress on food producers to adhere to a more stringent policy for food safety. Correll finally says, you can't cook the poop out of food. The FDA began the reportable food registry in 2009 to handle the overwhelming notifications to human health hazards their relaxed policies produced. The problems were hard to decipher with domestic food processing corporations, but foreign import food corporations added a cog in the wheel. These corporations generally go to greater lengths to preserve the safety of this food, more so than the FDA. As it stands, the FDA reconditions foods that we purchase in grocery stores. There was no way to know what foods are genuine and which have been reconditioned. On top of the already shocking list, we can add the ammonia pink slime in beef.
Yeah, high-paid beef industry job for officials who approve ammonia-treated pink slime. Can you imagine that?
The official approved the use of ammonia-treated sludge found in 70% of supermarket ground beef and 7 million pounds of beef headed for school cafeterias went on to take a high-paying industry job. As NBC News reports reveals, the Undersecretary of Agriculture, Joanne Smith, who approved the use of ammonia-treated sludge in ground beef products as a substitute to counter skyrocketing costs of beef, later received a high-paying job in the beef industry. To add insult to injury, the latest report also reveals that over 7 million pounds of sludge is headed to school cafeterias nationwide following the voluntary discontinuance of the product by many companies in the nation.
Yeah, and let me just read the rest of that part, but FDA admits chicken meat contains cancer-causing arsenic.
What?
Yeah. The new piece, chicken arsenic.
Oh,
Lord. It just gets sicker and sicker, folks.
I just had supper. I don't really feel like reading these. It makes me feel ill.
Almost, you know, and you wonder why people are queuing over.
Who read that?
Well, it said pink slime was found in 70% of supermarket ground beef in ABC investigation.
Yep.
Damn it, that's bad because we eat hamburger.
7 million pounds of pink slime beef headed for school cafeterias. That's horrible.
Yeah.
So that's, put that on that.
And I wanted to read a little bit on that,
They did a lot on the pink slime on TV.
No, not the pink slime. It was on the... on the chicken. For the last 60 years, the FDA has played dumb, claiming that they did not realize the arsenic deliberately added to chicken feed posed a threat to human life, claiming instead they believe the arsenic in the feed is excreted from the chicken before being consumed by humans. The chicken feed in question is voluntarily being pulled off U.S. shelves by Pfizer, one of the manufacturers of the feed, after research showed that a dangerous form of arsenic stays inside the chicken and does indeed pose a threat to human life. Wow. The arsenic, we eat chicken too, the arsenic in question is actually fed to the chickens based on the claims that it provides benefits such as promoting growth, which helps to maximize the profits of the corporations who sell the chicken to consumers. But even as Pfizer voluntarily pulls their own product off the shelves, the FDA continues its campaign of denial. In fact, the FDA has stopped short of banning the product or even putting into effect any type of regulation to stop future sales or use the product for similar products. Ironically, Pfizer says they will need to contact regulators in other nations to decide if there is a health risk to humans in these countries before they decide whether it will pull the product off the shelves in those nations. Well, isn't there, if there's a health risk to us, isn't there a health risk to Europeans or
anybody else? One would think so.
I mean, it's like, God, you know, absolutely sick. Arsenic, eat more. But even as its arsenic-contained product is pulled off the shelves, the FDA continues its campaign of denial. So just know that that's what's going on out there, guys. And, you know, hopefully you'll...
A little scary.
Hopefully you'll... yeah. This one was really frightening to me when you see this. And the fact that it came from China really made you really... It was stopped in South Korea.
Coming from China.
Right. And this is thousands of pills filled with powdered human baby flesh discovered by customs officials in North Korea.
In South Korea.
I'm sorry, South Korea.
South Korea has seized thousands of smuggled drug capsules filled with the powdered flesh from dead babies, which some people believe can cure a disease, officials said Monday. The capsules were made in northeastern China from babies whose bodies were chopped into small pieces, dried on stoves before being turned into powder, the Korean Customs Service said. Customs officials refused to say where the dead babies came from or who made the capsules, citing possible diplomatic friction with Beijing. Chinese officials ordered an investigation into the production of drugs made from dead fetuses of newborns last year. The customs office has discovered 35 smuggling attempts since August of about 17,450 capsules disguised as stamina boosters, and some people believe them to be a panacea for the disease, the customs service said in a statement. The capsules of the human flesh, however, contain bacteria and other harmful ingredients.
Smugglers told customs officials they believed the capsules were ordinary stamina boosters and did not know that the ingredients or manufacturing process. Ethnic Koreans from northeastern China, who now live in South Korea, were intending to use the capsules themselves or share them with other Korean Chinese. A customs official said they were carried in luggage or sent by international mail. All right. And... yeah, this is by the New York Post, by the way, this article. And hold on one sec. Pop-ups are the plague of the world. That and spam.
Buying any pills from China, that's for sure.
Yeah. The capsules were all confiscated, but no one had been punished because of the amount. It was deemed small and they weren't intended for sale, said the custom official who requested anonymity, citing department rules. China's State Food and Drug Administration and its health ministries did not immediately respond to questions faxed to them Monday. Chinese media identify northeastern China as a source of such products, especially Jilin province, which abuts North Korea. The Jilin Food and Drug Safety Agency is responsible for investigating the trade of such remains there. calls to the agency and the information office of Jilin's Communist Party were not answered Monday. South Korean Customs Agency began investigating after receiving a tip a year ago. No sicknesses have been reported from ingesting the capsules. But, you know how disgusting that is?
Be horrible.
Yeah, but at the same time, we read on the show, about a month or so ago, about the Pepsi and... and other companies using...
body parts, human body parts,
human
flavor enhancement.
Human fetuses for flavor enhancement. Yeah,
yeah.
It's like, what? I mean, it's cannibalism. I mean, they're pushing us into cannibalism here.
Yeah.
We don't even know it.
Horrible.
It's really sick. That's a really sick. This one was the most ridiculous thing. You know, when people, I swear to God, you know, climatologists are got to be mad, you know, to come up with ideas like this, but it had to be, yeah, I had to read it. Dinosaur flatulence may have led to global warming. Dinosaurs may have warmed the prehistoric Earth climate thanks to enormous amounts of methane-producing flatulence, researchers say. And this is from the, CBC News, right? Canada Broadcasting. Sauropods, the long-necked-tailed dinosaurs that included some of the largest ever land animals, could have produced enough methane to have an enormous effect on climate change, according to the report to be published in Tuesday's edition of Current Biology. Indeed, our calculations suggest that these dinosaurs could have produced more methane than all modern sources, both natural and man-made, put together. Dave Wilkinson, Livermore. This guy's getting paid as a scientist. Sauropods were plant eaters. As happens in cows, microbes in dinosaurs' digestive tract that aided digestion also produce methane, which is a greenhouse gas. Want to read the rest of that?
Co-authors Wilkinson and Graham Ruxton from the University of St. Andrews in Scotland made the calculations along with Ewan Nisbet, a methane expert at the University of London. Wilkinson said the group made an educated guess based on the large size of the animal, 20,000 kilograms for a medium-sized sauropod, and their population density. The calculations suggest sauropod flatulence about 150 million years ago when the world was warm and wet is comparable to the amount of methane produced today by both animals and society, and more than double what was produced before the dawn of modern industry.
This is so full of crap, it's unbelievable. You know, it's like, how can they even say this with a straight face, you know?
You notice if you read carefully, it says may have.
May have, yeah. I mean,
they don't really.
It's absurd. It's a total freaking absurd. Anyway, there's a lot of stuff here. Would you like to read that part? That one? I don't know.
Yeah, Ritalin uses stores fourfold in UK as psychologist one of untested drug cocktails. Yep.
And this is in the UK, of course, but they're doing the same stuff here.
Yeah, you got to be really careful not to.
Kids on this.
You want to make sure that your child has the right diagnosis, and you want to go to the right experts. You want to try everything possible before you use any drugs, I would think.
Okay, here we go.
Prescription of Ritalin for attention deficit hyperactivity.
I just wanted to say the raw story was the.
Oh, yeah. Hyperactivity disorder have quadrupled in a decade. Promoting fears is being pushed on children at the expense of alternative treatments and without appreciation of long-term effects. Figures released by the NHS Business Services Authority to the Liberal Democratic MP Tessa Munt revealed the number of prescriptions of methylphenidate hydrochloride, the generic name for Ritalin, rose in England from 158,000 in 1999 to 661,463 in 2010. Ritalin is a psychostimulant drug most commonly approved for treatment of ADHD in children. It is also used to treat conditions such as narcolepsy, and in certain cases may also be prescribed for lethargy, depression, and obesity. The Association of Educational Psychologists said its members were reporting an increase in children with behavioral difficulties being prescribed the drug in conjunction with antidepressants, despite the fact there was little to no evidence about the effect which these cocktails of drugs are having on the development of the children's brains. That's very scary. The association claims clinical studies show the beneficial effects of psychostimulant medication are not sustained over the long term, necessitating stronger and stronger dosages to be prescribed over time. and that it is becoming a common practice for children to be prescribed stronger dosages than recommended in the morning as a top-up or kickstart dose so that the medication lasts the full school day. Munt, who until recently sat on the Education Select Committee, said there were natural alternatives that could help combat ADHD. She highlighted a report commissioned by RSBP that suggested activities in natural environments appear to improve children's symptoms by 30% compared with urban outdoor activities and threefold compared to playing indoors. But Munn said many young people were prevented from enjoying the outdoors because of reasons such as lack of school playing fields and the distractions posed by video games, smartphones, and social networking. It is extremely alarming that in the decade up to 2010, prescriptions for Ritalin quadrupled, she said. Statistics show that 90% of prescriptions for this powerful drug in 2004 were used to combat behavioral problems in school-age children. I am shocked there has been such a huge explosion in use. ADHD is believed to be affect between 5% and 10% of school children in the UK. Symptoms include overactive and impulsive behavior and difficulty paying attention. The increase in Ritalin prescription appears to mirror the U.S., where there was an 83% increase in sales of the drug between 2006 and 2010. How many children are being prescribed the drug is difficult to quantify from official data. Monk said unless the Department of Health collects vital statistical data about prescribing habits, no one will know what is happening. We hear teachers tell of their students' lack of ability to concentrate, from police about increasingly disruptive and antisocial behavior, and from parents unable to control the actions of young family members. We need to show young people how to deal with normal stress and strains of growing up. Resorting to powerful drugs only stores up trouble for the future.
The Association of Educational Psychiatrists said it believed guidelines are not being followed. Guidelines recommend that the ADHD medication should not be prescribed to preschool children for the long term, nor in isolation from other therapeutic interventions without consultation. But the association said it was aware of a substantial increase in the number of children aged under 6, and in some cases as young as 3, being prescribed ADHD drugs. It said an informal survey of educational psychology practitioners across the West Midlands had revealed that there were more than 100 children under 6 on the medication in the area. This is reaffirmed across the country by our members, the association said. This is by the Guardian News.
Yeah, you want to think long and hard before you put your child on any prescription.
Yeah, you know, to put them on at that age is like, come on, you know. No, we didn't have any of that growing up, you know. And
but we had kids that couldn't learn and couldn't focus and couldn't behave.
Yeah. I don't know. Oh, God. There was a couple of more articles I wanted to read. There was actually even a video here that I wanted to play. Quick one. I can't find it. Here's one here. New Wall Street racket looting your city, one block at a time. When Mayor Rahm Emanuel introduced a new and innovative financing tool last month to help Chicago renovate failing infrastructure without participating in another budget crisis, many in the city were understandably critical. Chicagoans were already endured the notorious 75-year lease of their parking meters to a consortium headed by Stanley Morgan. Imagine that, by Morgan Stanley. Mm-hmm. And that sale promulgated a system wherein the public is held hostage by private finance, due largely to the inclusion of arcane legal stipulations like non-compete clauses, compensation events, in the language of the contract. So they're privatizing all of these things, and they're continuing to do that. And we're not, the taxpayer's not making any money.
No,
it's private industry, and well, what the hell for? And it's like, good Lord. Here we go. Okay. Ellen Bannon, writing in Northeastern, Northwestern Journal of Law and Social Policy, relates that Chicagoans learned about compensation events when CBS reported that the city's parking meter contract required reimbursements for events like repairing streets. Public records show that the first quarter of 2009, the city was liable to the parking meter contract, therefore, more than $106,000 in lost income during the slow months of the street repair and street closing for festivals, parades, and holidays, as well as repairs and maintenance. At that rate, it is not unreasonable to predict that Chicago will owe roughly $500,000 a year to the private contractors for them not collecting their fees. Right? I mean, what the hell's that the deal with for the contractor? What the hell's the deal for the city? Right? The city essentially acts as an insurer for the meter merchants, with the return being a one-time injection of roughly $1 billion with the previous mayor. Daily, and second, haphazardly exhausted on closing budget deficits in the waning years of his two-decade tour at the helm. And with the current infrastructure deal, Emmanuel has repeatedly claimed that this is not privatization. This is not like the parking meter deal. Huh. Can the public believe him? And here is how the infrastructure trust works. The city pays for upgrades to its roads, rail, and school with dollars pooled by Emmanuel's friends from the banking and investment world. Meanwhile, the city retains ownership of the infrastructure, though this comes at the cost of having to ensure a revenue stream for the fund. And Emmanuel's favorite example is his $225 million pet project to green retrofit some of the city's older buildings. The savings on energy usage stemming from the renovations are then extracted and used to pay off investors. Of course, the city would also sell municipal bonds to raise necessary funds and then use the savings and energy costs to pay the loan back at a much lower cost to the taxpayer. But then Emmanuel's friends and campaign donors would not be the richer for it. Well, the mayor bills his plan as bold and innovative, the reality could not be further from the truth. Public-private partnerships have been around for decades in the various forms, and their track record is replete with delays, cost overruns, and prolonged legal battles. What more, the beneficiaries of these investment mechanisms are those same rapacious Morgan Stanleys and Goldman Sachs that gave us the mortgage-backed security scandals and ensuring recession.
Ensuing recession.
Using the economic malaise they created as a cause, they have ratcheted up their advocacy of PPPs as a means of helping cash-starved public entities finance capital-intensive projects. The upshot is that they are holding us hostage all over again. They are using infrastructure built over decades with public monies as collateral to extract profits off the back of taxpayers. A cursory look at some past projects of this nature demonstrates that PPPs are often inefficient, overly costly, and inherently unjust.
Mm.
And they did this thing happen in the London tube nightmare. You want to read that?
The granddaddy of all PPPs debacles is the London Underground Metronet PPP. It's the brainchild of former Prime Minister Gordon Brown. The contract design kept London Underground in public hands while privatizing the renovation and renewal elements to the system. As with the Chicago parking meter deal, the contract was replete with virtually unintelligible legalese designed to give the private partners an advantage in court while also rendering public scrutiny of the contract extremely difficult. Bureaucratic costs related to drawing up the contracts with external bidders ultimately surpassed $500 million.
Oh, my God.
More than it probably cost
to build the whole thing, yeah.
Isn't that ridiculous?
Yeah, it's like this is what...
Throw these bums out.
Yeah, this is the kind of... And this is what Emmanuel was doing, you know? I mean.
Well, that's why he went there. That's why he was placed there,
you know? It's like, good Lord, these guys just...
Screw over the city.
Incredible crooks.
They really are. They're just criminals.
They're criminals.
And Congress is full of them.
Oh, God. And here's one in Orange County, privatized HOV lane. It's HOV lane.
Country's privatized
almost,
HOV lane.
Yeah, Orange County's here. Almost equal in disrepute to the London tube fiasco was the privatization of one high occupancy vehicle lane on California's SR 91. In the early 90s, the Orange County Transportation Authority proved incapable of procuring necessary funds for implementation of the new HOV using traditional revenue streams, so instead developed a private partnership to construct and manage the project, which opened December 27, 1995. This contract included non-compete clauses that prevented the public from providing necessary maintenance to the adjacent free lanes. Imagine that? Yeah.
They couldn't even fix the
adjacent lanes. Okay. The California Department of the Transportation hoped to add new lanes between SR 91 and another recently completed public toll road. These improvements would have violated the non-compete terms of the contract, though Caltrans argued there were overriding safety concerns that prevented them to proceed with the construction. The ensuing public row served
the ensuing.
Ensuing public row served to turn opinion against the private toll lane, and ultimately the outcry led to the passage of Assembly Bill 1010, which authorized OCTA to acquire the lane for $207 million
in
2003. And California's earliest experiment with private financing of a public-controlled entity like the London Tube came crashing to a premature halt on the heels of widespread public outrage.
Good.
Yeah, man. They got more and more. I mean, there's a lot of these towards sustainable investment. There's too many.
They put little catchy phrases on and fancy names. And what it is screw the public. That's
all. Oh, big time. Big time.
And the politicians are all bought off by these companies, and then they leave office and they go to work for them.
And you wonder why California is in such bad shape with deals like this. There's another one, the SDX, that they got involved with. Ever the epicenter of political innovation. It's also the site of another one of the most significant PPP boondoggles. In the case, Australian investment group Mark Furey led an assortment of banks that invested in a new expressway from San Diego to the Mexican border, beginning with the project since commencement in 2000 and lasted until the contract expired in 2042. However, faced with the challenges of the housing crisis and wider economic slump, the project faced persistent toll revenue shortfalls and ultimately filed bankruptcy last year. Meanwhile, the cost of the project jumped from $360 million to $843 million while being delayed for over a year in the bankruptcy proceedings. Oh, my God. And the expressway was created to administer the road and ultimately purchased by San Diego Association governments for $344.5 million. And there's others, too. I mean, it just keeps going on. So there's so many deals that just get, you know, the taxpayer just gets screwed royally. It's unbelievable. Peter's going to be coming up in just a few minutes.
Woody.
And let's see. Might as well have
a few minutes, I hope.
Yeah, we might as well.
Hope he didn't fall asleep while he's waiting for us.
Kind of funny there, but let me just play this quick video. Where Bahraini women and children are being raped and tortured.
Oh, that's...
Yeah, this is Bahrain. And it's only a 3-minute one.
She managed to watch the show and she phoned us and she said, my husband got arrested yesterday. And when the troops came to my house, they broke the door, they completely destroyed all the house. And she said, you know, all of them had their faces covered. And she said, and the Saudi troops physically and sexually assaulted me. And she said, they said like all these dirty words, which I don't even want to mention.
A lot of bad things are happening in Bahrain. Women and children are being raped and tortured. You can go to that video. But in the meantime...
It's on YouTube, actually. And, sorry, women and children.
In the meantime, we have Woody in the ring, and let's play his music right here. Mm-hmm.
Lila, good evening, sports fans. Watch your heads on the ropes as you step into the ring with Woody. Tonight's topics, NFL, NBA playoffs, and, of course, baseball. Let's get right down to the NFL. The NFL always seeming to be in the news, whether off-season or on-season. Former Saints defensive lineman Anthony Hargrove describes in a sworn statement how he was told by ex-defensive coordinator Greg Williams and current New Orleans assistant head coach Joe Vitt to deny the existence of a bounty program to the NFL investigators. In a document obtained Monday by the Associated Press, Hargrove acknowledges that he acted on Williams and Vitt's instructions to play dumb. If asked whether he was aware of the bounties being placed on former Vikings quarterback Brett Favre or another player. The declaration does not go into specifics, however, about just what Hargrove knew or did not know about the bounty program in New Orleans. And for that reason, it has become a point of contention between the NFL and the NFL Players Association. From the union's perspective, Hargrove's statement does not say he lied to anyone, nor does it state he or any other Saints participated in a bounty program that offered cash bonuses for hits that injured targeted opponents. You got to remember, this is an interesting line for the, you know, for the NFLPA. You know, on the one hand, they want to represent the player, and on the other hand, they also want to kind of go along with the league on, you know, player safety. You know, the league is only enforcing this kind of stuff because a lot of it involves injuries to players, and it's all about player safety. And the NFLPA would look bad kind of going along with things that jeopardize player safety. So it's kind of in a rock and a hard spot. So the NFLPA did advise all NFL players to obtain separate counsel. I kind of thought that was interesting. The NFL, by contrast, has said Hargrove's words acknowledge the existence of a bounty program and show Hargrove initially lied to NFL investigators about it. In describing Hargrove's declaration last week, Mary Jo White, a former U.S. attorney hired by the NFL to review its investigation, Mary Jo White, by the way, was asked, I believe, a big-time attorney for the state of New York. She did some big mob cases. So that kind of says a lot about, you know, who the NFL hires. So just remember that, you know, idiots that just play on the field. You're also going up against people that, you know, represented the United States of America, you know, the feds. And the feds are always tough to beat. Anyway, Hargrove, now with the Packers, was one of four players who received suspensions of various lengths in connection with the bounty probe. Hargrove was suspended 8 games. Saints linebacker Jonathan Vilma, as I already said last week, was for the entire season. Saints defensive end Will Smith in 4 games. And Browns linebacker Scott Fajita, 3 games. Vilma's attorney Peter Ginsburg called the NFL's characterization of Hargrove's statements misleading. All we know from declaration is what a couple of coaches were in trouble and hope for support from him. Anthony's declaration in no way supports that he lied, that a bounty system existed, or that players participated in any kind of inappropriate program. It's a shame that the NFL needed to have this mischaracterized that the declaration in order to justify these punishments. It's just another reason to conclude that the NFL pretty much has no evidence to justify what it has done to these players. The NFL has said the Saints bounty program was run by Williams from 2009 through 2011. Williams has been suspended indefinitely by the league and has apologized for his actions. Again, I don't know. They may have a tough time punishing players on this one, but I don't know. We'll see. The NFL always does seem to get its way, but this might be one of the times where they don't. But, you know, we'll certainly have to wait and see. It'll definitely very interesting. You know, the stuff takes place in every single locker room. Of that, you can be definitely short of. Moving on a little bit to the NBA. Tough playoffs for the Bulls. That's my team. They lost two of their main players. Derrick Rose is out, and one of their other major players is out too. So they're down in that series 3-1 to Philly. There's probably no way they're going to come back. Probably no way the Knicks will come back. although, they're down 3-1 as well, and then it goes back to Miami. Now, for 3 games, Carmelo Anthony has pretty much he's been at the core of the Heat's defensive scheme, and for 3 games, Anthony, his numbers are pretty pedestrian, 22 of 64, like basically 34%, and 21 points. Now, the Heat used LeBron James to cover Anthony early and late in games, and Shane Battier in the middle with fronting and doubling tactics along the way. Up 3-0, no one argued with that approach. But then Anthony finally had the game the next needed, and their fans desired, and the Heat kind of feared. He tore the Heat apart for 41 points in Game 4 to avert a sweep and force the series back to Miami for tomorrow's Game 5. Anthony had a great third quarter and even better fourth, largely at Battier's expense. Now, he was going to go out gunning, and, our job was to make him pay tough shots, according to Dwayne Wade. He took a lot of jump shots. We live with contested jump shots. We'll do the same thing next game. We've got great defenders on him, and we'll live with it. That's probably true. Frankly, I don't think he's going to have another monster game. Yeah, it's down in Miami. Miami's really going to want to close this one out. And as much as I say it, LeBron James is looking kind of like the LeBron James that used to play for Cleveland. He's looking, pretty good, and like he really wants it this year. And God, I only hope some team can stop him. But he, as I said, he's looking really good, and he looks like the guy that used to be in Cleveland when he was the best in the league. He hasn't played the best in the league since he's been Miami. He hasn't been a league MVP of that, I can assure you. But he's starting to look like it. So that's pretty dangerous for the rest of the league. I'm sure they'll finish off the Heat. The Heat will finish off the Knicks, and then we'll see what they play the next round. But, right now the Knicks got their hands full. Game 5, down in Miami, and, they're probably going to get beat. Moving on to a little bit of Major League Baseball. Mariano Rivera, Rays closer of all time. I guess his visit with the Surgeons yesterday was kind of expected. It was a result in a date. Everyone was expecting a date for surgery to repair the torn right ACL. However, things didn't go quite as smoothly as expected. We ran into complications, agent Fernando Cusa told the Post. I'm referring to Dr. Ahmad and Yankees general manager Brian Cashman for further information. Cusa can't really, reveal this kind of information. Cusa nor the Yankees would elaborate on what was discovered when Rivera met with Yankees team physician Dr. Chris Ahmad, Dr. Russell Warren, the Giants physician, and David Alchek, the Mets doctor. Alchek, by the way, works at my hospital, New York Hospital for Special Surgery, the number one orthopedic hospital in the world. I thought I'd throw in that free plug for them. It was suspected that the surgeons would concur with last week's diagnosis in Kansas City, and that Rivera had a torn ACL and a torn meniscus, and then, their plans for season-ending surgery will be made. I won't comment on that right now, Cashman said. He was at a hospital for special surgery and saw Dr. Warren and then saw both Dr. Ahmad. He was scheduled to see both. By now, the storyline, how Val Rivera suffered the injury as part of Yankee lore, shagging batting practice flies at Kauffman Stadium Thursday night. Rivera crumpled to the warning track, center field, just holding his right knee. And I happened to be watching batting practice. I saw it about 30 seconds after it happened. He just knew it wasn't good. But, this complication could be anything down to some medication that he's taking, anything. So, could have nothing to do with the knee. And I would bet my last dollar that it has nothing to do with the knee and that it's waiting for something else to clear up or for him to finish all some medication that he's taking or something along those lines. I guarantee that's what it will be. Now, I can't guarantee what's going to happen on Sunday, but I do know this. The Yankees will be pitching Andy Pettit. Now, Andy Pettit, he's been out of baseball for a minute. Hasn't pitched for, I believe, a year and a half. So he came back, and, he'll be starting on Sunday, Mother's Day, Yankee Stadium. He got banged up a little bit his last start, and God, Andy Pettit always kind of looked young, but, boy, he certainly looks kind of older now. I don't know, a year removed from the TV camera did it to him or something, but he's looking a little older. But we'll have to certainly see,
what happens on Sunday. As I said, he kind of got banged up a little bit out in AAA on Sunday. But, you know, the Yankees could choose to have Pettit pitch Friday or Sunday, but I think they gave him a couple extra days off because they want his, you know, arm to heal up a little bit. He threw in excess of 108 pitches. So, you know, they want, you know, him being a little bit older and so on and so forth, they give him a couple extra days. Otherwise, he'd be pitching Friday, which the game that I'm going to be back at. So that'll be kind of interesting. I'm going to see I believe Hughes will pitch on Friday. A little bit more baseball stuff. We'll move into a little bit of legal stuff here. New York Giants reliever, San Francisco Giants reliever, Guerrero Mota, was suspended for 100 games yesterday, becoming just the third major league player penalized twice for positive drug tests. The commissioner's office had said the 38-year-old right-hander tested positive for clenbuterol, which, by the way, is like a steroid, in November 2006 when he was with the Mets. Mota was suspended for the first 50 games season of 2007. A third positive test would result in a lifetime ban. So, he's in hot water. Not as much hot water as this guy's in, though. Roger Clemens. We'll get information from the trial. Clemens always reporting on him. Federal agent Jeff Novitzky testified yesterday that Clemens was not a target when Novitzky began questioning Clemens' former strength coach Brian McNamee about performance-enhancing drugs. When I refer to these performance-enhancing drugs, they're called PEDs. So in the future, I'll just say PEDs. I hope all of you can remember that, what a PED is. Under government redirect questioning, Novitzky said Clemens wasn't the only athlete Novitzky asked McNamee about. Novitzky said McNamee talked to him about a dozen professional athletes using performance-enhancing drugs. Was Clemens ever a target, prosecutor Stephen Durbin? No, he was never, Novitzky responded. We never targeted the end user of these drugs. Last week, under cross-examination, Clemens' lawyer asked Novitzky if it was his intent to have someone file charges against the pitcher. Novitzky, who had been an agent with the Internal Revenue Service when he met with McNamee in 07 and 08, said no. Clemens, a seven-time Cy Young Award winner, is accused of lying to Congress in 2008 when he denied using human growth hormone and steroids. McNamee cooperated with former Senator George Mitchell, who was investigating performance-enhancing drugs, PEDs, in baseball. Said Mitchell eventually identified Clemens as a user in this report to Major League Baseball. That's why he encouraged McNamee's cooperation. He said, we saw there was an issue with PEDs in Major League Baseball and that the kids were starting to emulate the players. We thought it was a good idea for Brian McNamee to cooperate with Mitchell. He said, adding he didn't know what was going to be in the report, including whether Mitchell's would even name names. They wasn't even sure if, you know, they were going to name names, which, of course, they ended up doing. They ended up naming names, and all kinds of names got released, and all kind of shady. You know, if you're going to release one name, just release them all, but whatever.
Peter, you have to wind up. We have only...
For this week, shout out to all my woodheads out there, Ron, Mark, Leo, Dino, Troy, Greg at AFS. The weather may not be nice today, but it'll be maybe nice in a couple of days. Let's enjoy it when it is. Have a good one, everybody.
And thank you, Woody. Just a little tiny bit of... And we only have a few seconds to say goodnight.
And thank everybody who joined us. And please join us again tomorrow night when I'm on.
Yep, when Leo's on. And then we'll be back again next week.
Yeah.
So have a good evening, folks. And we want to thank Woody for his segment in the ring. And we'll talk to you tomorrow. I'll be on tomorrow night. Tomorrow's Wednesday.
Oh, that's right. You're right. Sorry, I apologize about that.
Yes, I'll be on tomorrow.
We will be
and
on
then
tomorrow.
Leo will be on Thursday,
yes.
And then we'll be back next week. So,
okay, so
good night, folks.
Everybody. Yes, I forgot what day it was.
I was going to say, gee, that sounded weird, but so.